Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Susan Futrell. She is the director of marketing for a nonprofit called Red Tomato, and she's the author of a wonderful new book called Good Apples Behind Every Bite. And we're going to be talking with her in just a little bit, but first I want to share with you some things in around the news and some upcoming events. So, what a week. Every week seems to be what a week. This week I participated in the Meatless Monday campaign that Slow Food USA is promoting. And we've been talking about Meatless Monday for a long time, and as I wrote today in my blog, most days are Meatless Monday days here at IE Green. But I participated in the campaign that Slow Food USA was promoting, and that was to use the white flint corn grits that are grown by an indigenous tribe in Sea Island, I think it's South Carolina. And these are a wonderful grain that is really an endangered species. I mean, when you think of foods, so many of our foods, and we'll be talking about that later in the show too when it comes to apples, so many of our foods are endangered because they don't look perfect or because they're hard to manufacture on an industrial scale. And that was the case with the white flint corn grits. They have a thicker husk and they were not easy to grow and harvest on an industrial level. So they were really close to extinction, and the indigenous people down in Sea Island are working hard to bring them back, and with the help of the Ark of Taste, which is a program run out of Slow Food USA, actually Slow Food International, but we're talking about the USA chapter. And so I made white flint corn grits for my first time, and so I'm excited to share with you that recipe in just a little bit. And I even used the Long Island cheese pumpkin, which is also an endangered crop on the Ark of Taste list. And it's a really sweet pumpkin that's grown here on Long Island. So we'll be talking about that. I also went to a wonderful lecture series that is being moderated by Mark Bittman at Columbia University. That is really, you know, it seems like every Monday they have these, and they're really a wonderful opportunity to meet people in and working on the food movement. For those of you that don't know Mark Bittman, he was a New York reporter who is now working for a food delivery business. Mark Bittman is an incredible journalist and writer. He was a guest on my show years ago, and he is the moderator of this event. And coming up next Monday, there's one called The Food Movement at Home and Abroad, and Mark Bittman will be the moderator, and the speaker will be Nick Soule, who's the co-founder and president and CEO of Community Food Centers in Canada. And it takes place at the Vagelos Education Center up in Harlem. And it's, you know, I went this past week and saw some folks from the Small Planet Institute and some other wonderful people on a panel, and it was really great. So if you're interested in the food movement, you want to get yourself on the list up at Columbia to find out about these wonderful lectures that are taking place. Right now, my guest is down in Baltimore at the Northeast Sustainable Agricultural Working Group's annual conference called It Takes a Region. And that's taking place this weekend. If anyone has the motivation or desire to go to that, it's, you know, it really talks about setting up a regional food system, and it's a great organization to be a part of. So that is taking place. Tonight is the annual River Fund Gala. River Fund New York is the food pantry that I partner with when I do the cooking for the homeless, which I'll tell you about in just a little bit. But tonight is their annual fundraiser gala. a bit pricey, but it's wonderful. I'm not even positive if there's tickets left, but it's always a fun event. And this year it will be at Park Avenue in Manhattan, 583 Park Avenue. And the River Fund is just an incredible food pantry. It goes way beyond just handing out food. They get involved in every family that becomes their clients, and they help them with setting them up for social services. They help them with if they need shelters, or, you know, if there's any domestic abuse going on or anything. They're just a really wonderful resource for the community. And right now I think they feed more people in need than any other food pantry in the city. So they're really an amazing organization. November 14th, the Hudson River Watershed Alliance is having their annual conference, and that will be at the Henry A. Wallace Visitor and Education Center in Hyde Park, New York. And coming up next weekend, I can't believe it's here already, is I.E. Green's annual Thanksgiving Feast for the Less Fortunate. And this is where I partner with the Riverfront Food Pantry, and I'll have people coming here all weekend long participating in I start on Thursday and Friday picking up all the donated food that is getting donated to me and purchasing the food that is not getting donated to me. Right now I have 105 pledged turkeys coming to me. Of course, in order to keep all this cold, I need to rent a refrigerated tractor trailer that I'll park in my driveway and keep that running for the long weekend. And people will be coming through in shifts. If you haven't signed up yet and anyone's interested in signing up, you can find the sign-up link on my IE Green webpage or on my Facebook page. But people sign up, and this is my 23rd year doing it. And when I started, we would feed, 100 people, a couple hundred people. It's grown where there's now like probably 700 people or so that wait online in the park at Rufus King Park in Jamaica, Queens, for this free home-cooked meal. I really tag on to the River Fund's every other week movable food pantry, where they bring their food pantry out of their regular location in Richmond Hill, Queens, to this park in Jamaica, Queens, and they do this every other week. They have a movable food pantry, and so they will be handing out lots of food in addition to the hot dinner that we serve. We also have a huge coat drive where we've been collecting coats for months, and almost everybody walks away with a coat. We do all different kinds of sizes, and so many of my volunteers are also sorting the coats between men, women, children, large, small, the whole thing. So it's really a whole event. We're scrubbing sweet potatoes in the bathtub and regular potatoes in the other bathtub, and it's just, it's really a family event. People come with their kids. Kids can take a break and run around the I.E. Green homestead here and play frisbee and come back in. We have a station making Thanksgiving cards for the kids, so there's coloring paper and crayons and such. So it's just, there's something for everybody, so everyone can feel like they're doing something. And it's just been a wonderful event that I've been doing now. Like I said, this is my 23rd year, and I love all the people that I meet that come through this homestead to make this happen. So if you're interested, please sign up for that. What else is going on? Again, up at Columbia on November 20th, there's also another panel taking place. This time it would be Tom Colicchio, who's the co-founder and board member of Food Policy Action, wonderful chef, a celebrity chef for many restaurants in the city. He will be speaking along with Paula Daniels, who's the founder of the Los Angeles Food Policy Council, and Kathleen Finley, president of Glenwood and founder of Palades. And so that will be taking place on Monday, November 20th, also up at the Vagelos Education Center. And these events are free. Actually, you just have to register online to make sure there's room. But, it's a pretty full house, but it was really a wonderful event this past Monday. November 28th to the 30th, Bionutrient Food Association is having their 7th annual Soil and Nutrition Conference. And, you know, this is a wonderful opportunity to really learn about the soil. This past week, the organic farmers really took a hit when the National Organic Standards Board allowed hydroponics to be considered organic. And that was really, really sad for so many of the organic farmers. You know, I agree with them. I really feel like hydroponics should have its own labeling. I mean, I think hydroponics is a great way of the future and has a lot of great potential, but it's not the same as organic. It's not the same thing as farmers who are working to regenerate the soil and to give back into the soil, because soil is also a wonderful resource to help mitigate the problems of climate change. I mean, a lot of our industrial agricultural system adds to the global footprint and to climate change. But soil is also a wonderful sequester of CO2 into the soil and helps mitigate some of the problems of climate change. So those farmers that are really farming their soil organically and regenerating the soil are really doing a whole different job than a hydroponic farmer. So it should have separate labeling. And we also don't know what the nutrient liquid that they're feeding the hydroponic plants is really made of. You know, there's all different types, and of course it's, you know, information that they don't want to share. They say it's proprietary information, so who knows what's in some of that those liquids. Some, I would guess, are better than others, as in so many of the things that we deal with. But it's something to certainly think about. So before I introduce you all to Susan Futrell, I want to share my recipe with you. As I said, I made a recipe that used two of the Arc of Taste foods from the Slow Food Arc of Taste program. One is the white flint corn grits from Sea Island, and the other is the Long Island cheese pumpkin. And honestly, I have to admit, this was my first time ever cooking grits, period. I'm from the north, not the south, so grits is not really something that I have ever really used, but they were so good. So I certainly will be using them again. So I started with 1 cup of Sea Island white flint corn grits, and you can order them online. Anson Mill Farms, I think, is selling white flint corn grits, and I'm sure there's others as well, so just Google it and you can order it online. Long Island cheese pumpkin. I used a Long Island cheese pumpkin that I grew here. If you can't find that, you can use, you know, any other type of heirloom pumpkin or squash in place of the pumpkin. And for the pumpkin, I deseeded it, I peeled it, and I cut it into 1-inch cubes. I used coconut oil as my oil. I used 2.5 cups of water, 1 can of coconut milk, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 carrots that I diced into small pieces, 1 onion chopped, 1 teaspoon fresh minced ginger, 1/8 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/4 cup of apple cider vinegar, 1/4 cup of maple syrup, 2 tablespoons chopped parsley, and 1/4 cup of toasted slivered almonds, and those were optional. So I started with in a small pot. I brought the water to a boil, added the coconut milk and the salt, and once it was boiling, I slowly added the soy grits. I'm sorry, slowly stirred in the soy, why I keep saying that, the corn grits, into the boiling water. Then I brought it back up to a boil and then reduced it to a simmer and cooked it for about 30 minutes, stirring occasionally. Then I added the cinnamon and the parsley when it was finished, just stirred that and set it aside for a minute. I laid out the pumpkin cubes on a baking sheet lined with parchment paper that I had greased with a little bit of coconut oil, sprinkled it with a little salt, and roasted that in a 450-degree oven for 20 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes until it's soft, depending on the size of your cubes. Remove that from the oven. And then in the cast iron pan, I sautéed the onions and carrots with a little salt in some coconut oil until soft. I added the ginger and cooked for another 5 minutes. And then I added the onions and carrots into the pot with the soy grits and mixed that up. And using the same pan, I wiped out the pan, and I added the apple cider vinegar and the maple syrup and let that cook just down just a little bit until it gets a little syrupy, and I added the cooked pumpkin to that and just let that simmer for a few minutes until the pumpkin absorbs the maple syrup and the apple cider vinegar. And I served it by putting out the grits into a bowl and spooned the pumpkin on top in the center, and I garnished it with some parsley. If you were going to use the slivered almonds, you can garnish it with the slivered almonds as well. And that's it. It came together, you know, pretty quickly. It's wonderful as a side dish or a main dish. Really, really delicious. Everybody loved it. The coconut milk gave the corn grits just enough fat that it just was delicious, you know, because this is a vegan recipe, so it has no dairy or butter, where so often soy. The corn grits, you would add some butter to that or maybe some cheese to that. So anyway, please make the recipe. Let me know what you think. I hope you all enjoy it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. Susan Futrell is the Director of Marketing for Red Tomato and author of Good Apples, Behind Every Bite. And Susan's worked in the food business for nonprofit organizations and farms in marketing and distribution for over 35 years, including over two decades in the natural and organic foods industry. She's a freelance writer, an essayist, and a consultant, has an MFA in nonfictional writing from the University of Iowa. And right now, she's currently the director of marketing for the nonprofit Red Tomato, which does marketing, logistics, and market development for a network of fruit and vegetable farmers in the Northeast U.S. She helped develop the Eco Apple program, which we'll talk about in a little bit, which is a collaboration among fruit growers, researchers, and scientists from land-grant institutions and nonprofits, which supports advanced ecological orchard and pest management practices with a goal of sustaining local fruit production in the U.S. And Susan, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
I am now very hungry listening to that recipe.
Ah, it's really good.
Wonderful.
Like I said, you know, I'm not, you know, I've only had corn grits a few times when I've traveled, and I was not a huge fan, but I have to say these were delicious. So I was really happy. But I'm really happy to have you on. I really enjoyed reading your book, Good Apples, Behind Every Bite. And it's really interesting that with your diverse background that you ended up focusing on apples. Can you tell us what sparked your interest in apples?
Sure. And first, thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be on the show and part of all the interesting and diverse kind of topics that you cover.
Thank you.
And that, in some ways, is part of what led me to apples. I've loved apples ever since I was a kid. Many people share that love, and
sure.
It's very easy to start a conversation about apples. But as I have been working more closely with a network of apple growers and fruit scientists the last 10 or 12 years, I also began to really appreciate everything else about apples and growing apples that I had no idea. So I chose apples partly because I love them and want people to appreciate some of the history and complexity and wonderful variety, but also because they're a very good lens into some of the kinds of challenges that family-owned farms and local food producers face in the larger food system. And I think it's an interesting way to learn more about what some of those challenges are and maybe what we as citizens and eaters can do to help shift the levers in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. And I was very impressed to read that you helped to start the Eco Apple program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, I'd be glad to. I didn't help to start the program. It was started at Red Tomato, the nonprofit where I work, by a group of six orchards, a network of land-grant scientists, and a couple of nonprofits, Red Tomato, which was founded by Michael Rosine, and the IPM, or Integrated Pest Management Institute of North America, founded by Tom Green. So that group of people in around 2004 began to look at what it would take to help fruit growers in the Northeast who face a very daunting array of pest and disease challenges. About 90-some percent of the organic apples grown in the U.S. are grown in Washington State. And we can talk a little more about the reasons for that, but part of it is that the growing conditions there lend themselves to the kinds of approaches and treatments that are specifically allowed in the organic standards. In most of the rest of the country, there are climate and temperature and disease and pest issues that make it very difficult to produce commercially viable fruit. In other words, a lot of those treatments that are needed are there because people don't want spots on their apples. So in the Northeast, there's a whole network of growers who have for many, many years, decades really, been promoting and experimenting and kind of pushing the envelope with very high standards of ecological production, and they use a lot of advanced practices as well as good old-fashioned common sense and knowledge to develop ecosystems in the orchards, use beneficial insects and natural predators, create a growing environment that allows them to manage with a minimum of the use of any toxins. But they're pretty invisible in the market. And as you probably know, when you're a shopper, you go in and you kind of look at the labels. You have a few seconds to make your choices. It was very hard for these growers who are taking extra risk and putting in extra effort and cost to have consumers recognize those efforts and support
and
them in the market.
And be willing to pay for them.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the program Eco Apple is both a production program supported by this network of scientists and nonprofits. There's a certification process that happens every year to verify adherence to the production protocols. And then the really key part of it that we're involved in at Red Tomato is a marketing program to brand and promote and support those products once they get out into the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. So they're not organic, but they're closer to it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And I think some of our growers would say that for the conditions here in the northeast part of the U.S., in some ways these practices can actually be more ecological than organic, depending on the substances and the treatments that they're having to use. So it's a very conscientious, responsible approach. With a lot of common ground with organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that. I guess, like, in organic, I think they can spray with copper or sulfur or, you know, which some people say is more toxic in a sense than some of the ecological things that they spray with that are not considered organic. I mean, I don't know. I'm not doing it, but
I think a helpful thing to remember is that anything that any grower is spraying is toxic at some level, because that's the whole point of it. They're trying to get rid of something. And it's true that in the organic standards, copper sulfate and sulfur are allowed. And in certain conditions and uses and levels of use, that can be a very appropriate way to treat for problems in a orchard with a high humidity and a certain kind of climate. If you're treating with those substances every week over and over and over again, it can be a very negative type of consequence. And if you can treat, you know, once or twice with something synthetic that is limited in its impact, that can be a good solution in a situation like like the Northeast. And I will say, as many of your listeners know, the Northeast is a fabulous place to grow apples. It's where apples first came into the North American continent. Their apples have been grown here for years and years, and many things about the growing conditions here, the cold nights, the shift from summer into fall, are absolutely perfect for growing apples. So this is a network of orchards that is experienced. Some of them are 12 generations of farming in this part of the country, and they're very focused not only on the quality of the product and just fabulous tasting apples, but also on doing it as ecologically as possible. Mm-hmm. So we feel really we're dedicated to supporting them and telling people their story. And we have quite a bit of information on the Red Tomato website for people who really want to see the details. If you're a total science nerd, you can read the protocol and the whole thing, mm-hmm. but also a list of the orchards that participate in the program.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was interesting to find out that, you know, apples are not indigenous to the U.S., you know, other than a couple crab apple trees. But, you know, I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you, I'm just thinking, you know, when they first brought the apple seeds over and started growing them, I mean, there was not any synthetic, you know, pesticides then or fertilizers. What did they do then? Is it just that they, back then, people didn't mind spots on their apples or holes and they just would dig around that and eat the good part? Or, you know, have the amount of pests grown so much that now it's a problem? Do you know that?
It's a little bit of both. That's actually a really good question. One of my favorite things that I learned about apples when I started doing the research for the book was that they're immigrants, like so much of the rest of this country. And so when you say American as apple pie, it's very true. They're a transplant from originally Kazakhstan and moved through Europe and came over. And in the beginning, I think a couple things were going on. One is exactly what you said. People weren't worrying about how the apples looked. In some cases, they weren't even worrying about how they tasted. They were using them for vinegar or cider, and also as a way to stake a land claim and sort of put down roots, very literally. So there was a lot less of a need to focus on exactly how perfectly beautiful and round and unblemished they looked. The other thing is that over time, they're delicious, right? Apples, we love the way they taste. Mm-hmm. So do insects. And so over the history of apple growing in the U.S., there have been various kinds of insect pests that apple growers have attempted to manage. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, one of the things that was used to manage them was arsenic. And, of course, now we know that's extremely toxic, and it's toxic in the soil as well as on the fruit. But there's kind of been a steady progression over time of finding more effective and hopefully over time with good public science and the right kind of research, less toxic and safer treatments to use. The other two things that are going on are more market-related in that, people care more as they're shopping in the grocery store now than they did 100 years ago about what things look like. It's part of how we choose our fruit. And because of global trade, there also are increasing challenges from invasive insects. So new pests coming into an environment where they're not native and kind of wreaking havoc both on the orchards and also in some cases on the carefully built up ecosystem and integrated management systems, so that there's just a constant challenge of learning how to manage those too.
Hmm. Wow. So many different things to think about. You just, you know, because I grow peaches and I grow apples here on my property. And you know, I do everything organic, but I'm not trying to support myself from these crops. And I can tell you, I mean, my peaches are the most delicious peaches, but there's bruises and fungus, all this stuff, all, you know, like they're not beautiful looking. And I have to cut around them, but I do. And they're the juiciest, most delicious peaches. And the same with my apples. You know, there will be a little hole in it where a worm went in. I just cut around it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're misshapen, and they're, you know, they're certainly not the beautiful apples you see at the store. But I know they're organic, and they're certainly delicious. And so, you know, I think about that. I think, oh, well, this is how they used to all look.
It's probably true. And
right.
Yeah, very much that amazement that you just expressed, like, wow, all of the things that go into this is part of what motivated me to write the book and tell a little more of the story, because I think as eaters, the closer we are to the people who are actually growing the food and picking the food and bringing it to market, the harder it is to be really doctrinaire about how that gets done. And if you shop at a farmer's market, that's familiar. You get to know the grower, and you start to have sympathy for the challenges and also trust in the decisions that they're making. And I wanted to bring a little bit of that insight into what it's like to be an apple grower to people. The flip side of that for me that really emerged in my thinking as I was working on the book was the responsibility that we have as eaters to support the public science and research, to be a little less demanding about cosmetics, to be willing to try new varieties, even if we're always used to the same one and we know we like it, because all of those things really are part of what make it possible for apples to be grown in different regions of the country under different conditions. And I think if we're interested in a localized food system, diverse, ecological, there's a responsibility that we have to provide the kind of support system that allows growers to grow food that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Susan, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about how we can get the word out and what Red Apple's doing to try to get the word out to people like myself who are so committed to organic that I choose the apples coming from Washington State over local apples because eating organic is important to me. And yet, you know, if I knew that the apple grown right here upstate New York, where I know so many people go apple picking, but I won't, you know, if I understood more, maybe I would eat those apples. So when we come back, let's talk a little bit about that, okay?
Great. Sounds good.
You're tuned to PRN. We'll keep bringing you the best in alternative voices for social and political news, the environment, health, the economy, and a whole lot more. All you have to do is keep listening. PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Activist Radio on the Progressive Radio Network is a weekly program for all Americans who are not in the wealthiest 1% of the U.S. population. Fred and Eli offer a little history you didn't learn in high school, some news stories you haven't seen on our mainstream media, and a couple of songs to help you join the resistance. Our website, classwars.org, offers a little background on how the few richest of our citizens lie to the rest of us to expand their power and wealth. Class wars is a dirty term in our media, which always implies that America is above such crudeness. But the very rich are not above that at all. They are sick with greed, of course, but so far the rest of us are what might be worse. We haven't organized yet to fight back. So gear up for some class wars every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. That's www.prn.fm.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm talking today with Susan Futrell, who is the author of a wonderful new book called Good Apples Behind Every Bite. She's also the director of marketing for a nonprofit called Red Tomato. And we're talking about the history of apples and the future of apples. So, Susan, you with me?
Yes, I am.
Great. So, can you talk a little bit about, the choices, for people like myself who chooses organic versus local, if I have to make a choice. I mean, of course, local and organic's the best. I will choose shipping something in from somewhere else, like Washington State, in order to have an organic apple versus one that I think of as being sprayed heavily with pesticides. Can you talk about the apples that are grown locally that are more ecological and what kind of residue do they have on them, and are they a better choice in your opinion? Because I know your heart is where mine is when it comes to eating organic, good, real food. Can you share with us the pros and cons?
Yeah, sure. First I want to say, I'm so going to encourage you not to deny yourself the pleasure of going out to a local apple orchard in the fall. I think, again, getting to know some of these producers and just experiencing what it's like to be in this beautiful setting with this bountiful fruit all around you and being able to pick it yourself, that's part of what I think will help break down some of this more fearful thinking around food. And the second thing I want to say is that I think as you do that and as you get to know more of the producers in your region, wherever you are, there are apples being grown in every single state in the U.S. So no matter where you are, it's possible to grow apples and to have apples locally. The general approach to apple growing, organic or not, has been over time a steady continuum moving toward less and less toxic treatments. And so I think the idea that they're sprayed heavily in the first place is not something you need to worry about. There are lots of differences from orchard to orchard, but even among the orchards that participate in our network, the EcoApple, beyond that, there are lots and lots of orchards in most every part of the country that are working hard to use kind of advanced practices and be careful about what they're doing. They're required to do that. They're, things that have to happen to make sure apples aren't sprayed and the fruit's not sprayed. So first, I guess I want to say just get out there and get to know some local apple producers and experience that. I think the second thing you said is really important, which is to talk about the trade-offs. So I'm a very strong advocate for organic. I spent many years in that industry and working on the organic standards, and I do believe in that kind of production. But I also am a very, very strong advocate for local and regional food systems. I believe that we are better off if there are more farms in more parts of the country producing more diverse kinds of crops and foods for all kinds of reasons. So I think each person has their own priorities and reasons for shopping the way they do. And I think what I would say is that there are going to be trade-offs no matter what your choices are. And as you're thinking about those, to be more familiar with what's grown in your region and who those growers are. Expand your tastes a little around different varieties that might do well in one part of the country and require more chemicals in another part of the country because of different growing conditions. So really just expanding your taste and thinking is one important way to support local growers. The other thing I want to make sure to talk about is that In the last chapter of my book, I titled A Democracy of Apples, and mm-hmm. I stumbled on that term reading long ago, reading Michael Pollan's wonderful book, The Botany of Desire. He references a little essay by Henry Ward Beecher, who was an abolitionist and social reformer in the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s, and he wrote this charming little essay on apples as a democratic fruit. And I sort of initially thought, oh, what a lovely idea. Everyone likes apples. They're available everywhere. They're kind of the common ground for all of us. And I think, yes, all of that is true. But I really came to appreciate that in a new way, in the sense that as a democracy, we do have a responsibility. If like I do, we consider food to be a common good, then we have to have a system of support, and particularly I want to advocate for support for public science and research, as well as support for the kinds of local and regional food systems work that's happening here at NESOG today, to really build a food community and a food society where farmers can grow in the ways that we all wish they would grow and do it and make a living and be able to stay on their land and support their families. So I'm promoting this idea of a new collective noun for apples, the way you talk about a murder of crows. I want to say a democracy of apples is the collective noun for what we as citizens and eaters can do to help support and nurture the kind of apple growing everywhere in the country that that we would like to see every time we bite into a wonderful apple.
Mm-hmm. You know, just coincidentally, this week in my newsletter, I also wrote about this GMO apple that being promoted right now. I'm sure you've heard about the Arctic apples that are hitting actually 400 stores out in the Midwest, where you're actually from.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they're here in the Northeast right now, but I put out a challenge to, you know, my network of people that get my newsletter to join the Organic Consumer Association, and they're really trying to get people to sign up and find where these apples are being marketed, because they're not telling you. You know, it doesn't say GMO apple on it. They don't have to label it. But these apples are being pre-sold, and they, you know, the thing that the big selling point about them is that when you cut them, they don't turn brown. So you can, like, cut them and have them stay, you know, in your refrigerator for a month, and they're still going to look like they just were cut. And people think this is a good thing.
Well, it remains to be seen whether people think this is a good thing. I think, I've been following that story as well. And actually, while I was researching the book, I spoke with some of the people at Arctic Apple, and, you know, learned a little bit about what they're doing. They're very proud of the fact that these are GMO apples, so I think it's true they're not being labeled and marketed necessarily that way, but they're very excited about the technology and happy to tell you all about it. It's interesting for a couple reasons to me. One is that there actually are varieties of apples that naturally tend to stay white after you cut them. So if that's something you're worried about, Cortland's, Pink Lady, Ginger Gold, Golden Delicious, I mean, you can poke around and learn about different varieties. And so whether this technology is really solving an important problem for the world, I'm not so sure. But I do think it's going to be a little bit of a bellwether in terms of how willing consumers are to accept that technology. In this case, they're not adding genes from another species, but they're using a technology to turn off some of the genetics inside. And if the apple, you know, hits the market and becomes popular, I think one of the things I learned is that many of the growers, particularly in regions like the Northwest, where there are big concentrations of apple orchards, they're all very close together, growers are not that excited about this new fruit and not that interested in growing it to a large extent, partly because they're worried about contamination in the pollen and worried about consumer reactions to it damaging the credibility of the apple industry. So a lot of them kind of don't want to have much to do with it. And I think it is going to be interesting to see, you know, for all, I mean, for whatever you think about GMOs, and there are all kinds of questions and things to be considered there. I think it's partly just going to be interesting to see whether people care enough about their apples turning brown.
So do you have any idea what farmers they found to grow these apples in the first place?
I don't. I know it's very proprietary, and the original technology, I believe, was developed in Canada, in Western Canada. But I know there are growers in the U.S. growing it. I just don't know who and where.
Really interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah. Meanwhile, look for Cortland's in your market. They're in the market now. They're fabulous Northeast apple, and they're it takes them a long time to turn brown.
And what about, you know, every once in a while you get a new apple will hit the markets and become the latest craze, like Honeycrisp.
Yeah.
You know, years ago there was no Honeycrisp. What is Honeycrisp a crossbreeding of different apples to create Honeycrisps?
It is, and you hit on one of the strategies now that apple growers all over are using to sort of stay in the marketplace and compete with the 365 days a year bounty of fruits and that come from all over the world now, and that is to come up with new varieties and market them. And in many cases, there are proprietary marketing agreements for all kinds of new varieties. Honeycrisp was an apple that was bred at the University of Minnesota. It was actually kind of almost an accidental find, a tree that was about to be let go in the orchard, and they moved it to a different place and let it go and tasted the fruit and realized, oh my gosh, these are so crisp and so juicy. And you're right, they've just kind of hit like a craze. Everyone seems to love them.
They are really good.
Yeah. They're hard to grow in some places. They're turning out to be a little temperamental. And one of the things that's happening now is that there are breeding programs trying to improve on the Honeycrisp. So I would say watch for something called Cosmic Crisp that Washington State University has been working on and just released. There's a growers cooperative based in the Midwest and the Northeast that has a wonderful apple called the Evercrisp. And these are all being bred based on the Honeycrisp cross to either be more disease resistant or easier to manage, or in some cases to improve on the color or the crispiness. So I would say the flood of new varieties coming into the market is not about to slow down. And whereas a few years ago, really, you could almost only find 5 or 6 varieties of apples.
Right.
Now it's common to go in and to see, you know, 10 or 20 of these mostly new varieties. Meanwhile, there are thousands of old heirloom varieties, which are still pretty hard to find. That's another reason I would encourage you to get out to some of your local orchards, because they almost all have at least a few trees of the not-so-popular varieties that are really fun to learn and taste.
Can you tell us a few of them that you really like?
Oh, sure. There's a great one up in the New England area called the Roxbury Russet, which was actually the first named apple grown in North America. In what is now Roxbury in Boston, there's still some really old trees up there. It's a crispy apple that's really good eaten fresh, but it also makes great pie and cooks really well. It's got a little more complex sweet tart flavor. What else? I have a favorite Midwestern apple that was developed in the, I think, in the 1800s in at Cornell Experiment Station in the public land grant system called the Jonathan. That's another, it's a bright, it's a very deep red, kind of small round apple, and it just has fabulous crisp tart flavor. Everybody's got a favorite apple, and this is one of the things that's so wonderful is that if you like sweet, you can find sweet. If you like tart, you can find tart. If you want to cook with them, some are better for that. It's one of the really wonderful things about them.
I did a program this week, a slow food in school program. It's I go into a nursery school every season, and this time I made applesauce with all of them, you know, and so I had the apple cranks, and everybody got to peel and core their apples, and then we made applesauce, and I used a bunch of different varieties, and the kids just loved it, you know. It was so much fun to
the best applesauce and the best pie are if you mix varieties, in my opinion. You get the best flavor that way.
You know, so much of in the news these days is also about food waste and, you know, how much of our food gets thrown out. I was just wondering, you might be the perfect person to ask, is there anything you can do with crab apples? You know, you talk about that being the indigenous apple to the U.S. Is there, do people cook with crab apples? Is there anything you can do with them? Because I have buckets of them.
I hear you. And they are often planted around commercial varieties to help with pollination. So there's crab apples all over the place. You know, you can, they vary. Some are more bitter and harder to deal with than others. There's a little crab called the Dolgo crab that's a little large. The fruit's a little bit larger than what you would typically see. And it's a little bit sweeter, and you can do you can mix that in with things. I came across a few references to in Native American cooking to using crab apples mixed in with other things. So if you poke around, there may be some recipes like that. I tend to think of them as really wonderful bird, you know, attractants for birds. which isn't necessarily good if you're trying to protect your orchard from birds, but if you're in your backyard, it's a nice feature.
And you also talk a little bit in your book about how apples are affected by climate change. How does climate change affect the growing of apples?
This is another place where I think for all of us, kind of broadening our own sense of what we can be responsible for that has an impact on the food. And the climate change effect for apples is in a few different ways. One really immediate and serious is just the increase in incidences of extreme weather. So hail in the middle of summer when the fruit is just beginning to develop and it is really soft can just devastate an orchard, you know, wipe out an entire crop. A few years ago, actually the example I'm thinking of was peaches, not apples, but a few years ago there was a very warm winter. Things budded out and started to blossom early in the spring, and then there was a very cold, hard freeze, and there were no peaches in the northeast part of the U.S. Last year because of that. So those things, it's also affecting the varieties that can be grown in different regions. So if you're in a part of the country where you used to have a favorite apple, and it's getting harder and harder to find, one reason might be that as the warming trend shifts north, different varieties that could be grown are no longer suitable, and they're trees, and so it's not a quick process for that turnover. And the third way that, again, is one of the most devastating in the big picture, and that's the introduction of invasive species that, as climate shifts, can thrive further and further north and spread easily. There's a fruit and vegetable pest called the brown marmorated stink bug that came into the U.S., I think originally in Pennsylvania, and has been a challenging thing to manage. It goes into people's houses in the winter.
They're horrible.
Oh, they're horrible. And there's a fabulous national project funded by the USDA, so it's public science. It's directed toward the public good, and it's a network of researchers all over land-grant universities around the country learning about the pests, developing different ways to trap and monitor it, and most recently and most happily, they've begun to find a predator, a parasite that in its native habitat appears to keep these things under control and in balance, and so there's some encouragement that eventually it won't require harsh chemicals to manage. It's something that can be brought back into a balance, but it takes years and millions of dollars of research, and I think those are the kinds of things we want our public good to be pointed toward.
Yeah, it's also, those can also be scary sometimes. I forget what they were talking about. They were going to release actually a whole bunch of GMO.
Oh, mosquitoes? The mosquitoes.
GMO, some sort of bug up in the Cornell Ithaca area just recently.
I read about that.
Right? You know, it's like, so then that has a downside. I mean, everything has, you know, like you said, the pros and cons of every decision we make is questionable, and we just don't always know. So, you know, you bring in another bug that is a predator of the stink bug, and then, you know, what does that bug do, you know?
Yes. So, in the opening of the book, I included a quote from one of my heroines and favorite writers, Rachel Carson, and at some point in her book Silent Spring, she wrote, "In nature, nothing exists alone." And I really, the more I learned about apples, the more real that became for me. That just as you say, there everything affects everything else, and there's a connection. Whatever happens locally and globally, it's very much all connected. And
amen.
I think that's the
You're
good
so
news
right.
and the bad news. I mean, the good news is that it does mean that these local levers that we can apply to moving things in a positive direction really do have an effect. And
they
that
do.
Was the most
so,
encouraging
you know what?
Thing
I can't believe
me.
How fast time goes. We're just about out of time. So before we run out completely, can you share with everybody your website and that of Red Tomato so that people can find out more information?
Absolutely, and thank you so much for the opportunity. I really have enjoyed talking with you.
Same here. Been wonderful.
Red Tomato's website is redtomato.org. There's a link there to information on our the producers and farms we work with and also on the eco program. If you want some more backstory, we also have a website called righteousproduce.com, which has information on the workers who pick apples, some of the farms we work with, and more about the supply chain. And my website, which has links to the book and readings and upcoming events, is susanfutrell.ink, ink as
wonderful.
In writing.
Wonderful. Well, Susan, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you joining us. And everyone out there listening, thank you once again for tuning in to IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.